is the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, this is Eric back with you. Today we're going to jump into a quick podcast. I know two podcasts ago I talked about dopamine and Levofed, and I said we're going to continue with that series, and we are. I just felt like this was an article that I read. Had some debate, discussion regarding this with Alan Wolf, and we just had kind of a good conversation about the different aspects of this study and, you know, pros and cons and things like that. I thought it was a good way to discuss these concepts, and so I thought it was a good way to put out a podcast regarding passive oxygenation and the new studies that have been published recently in the American College of Emergency Physicians, and specifically an article that was published by Scott Weingard, the author and doctor that does the MCRIT podcast. I'm sure you're all aware of that. And then Richard Levitan, that is a doctor that is very focused on airway management and the different aspects of resuscitation regarding airway management, RSI, and things like that. So some interesting things that they bring up in this study that I just wanted to bring to you guys. I think that we can all learn from, again, critical care medicine, emergency medicine at the MD level. And that's the whole focus of this podcast, is to bring that type of care down to the pre-hospital EMS HEMS industry. Because I think that we can apply these concepts in the same ways that they do. The first thing that we have to understand is, what is passive oxygenation? And we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but essentially we need to provide oxygenation in a way that optimizes alveolar filling, nitrogen washout, nitrogen release, in an attempt to bring up our PO2 as high as possible during our RSI procedure. And we've learned that providing back valve mask ventilations to these patients only causes further problems. We fill the stomach with air, gastric contents, if they've had any food recently. A lot of times, based on this increase in gastric air, they can vomit. That increases morbidity and mortality. It causes a higher incidence in VAP, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and things like that. And it just makes our care much more difficult. So we've learned that in patients that are actually maintaining their own airway, they're not apneic. And most of our patients that we RSI are maintaining their own airway in some way. We just need to manage to establish an airway that protects them from further harm. And that's the whole point of RSI. So we've learned that providing an oxygen source based just on general Graham's law, which is diffusion, going from a higher concentration to a lower concentration, provides good oxygenation. So we do this in two ways. We provide oxygenation with a non-rebreather mask at 15 liters per minute. We hook that up to one oxygen source, and we also provide it with a nasal cannula, and we hook that nasal cannula up to a second oxygen source. That gives us approximately 60% FiO2. Now, there's some argument, and this is one of the debates I was having with Alan Wolf, of how much does a nasal cannula actually provide? This literature in this paper actually states that you can provide up to 15 liters per minute with a nasal cannula. But the problem that I have with this, and again, I'm not going against what Scott Weingard and Richard Levitan are saying, but for applying this to a pre-hospital setting, a normal nasal cannula can only provide 8 liters per minute. I mean, that's what the literature has always stated. That's a maximum of 50 to 60% FiO2. And what they're referring to in this paper, and I will publish this paper, the link in the show notes on this podcast. You can read this for yourself. They're stating that you can use high capacity nasal cannulas that are humidified, that allow for humidification. And based on that, you can provide up to 15 liters per minute. And that's great. Regardless of what you believe or what type of equipment you're using, for us pre-hospitally, we're not going to have access to that type of nasal cannula. So just utilizing a nasal cannula in and of itself, providing 8 liters per minute, a second oxygen source during your RSI procedure, and maintaining that nasal cannula on throughout the whole process during the intubation process is essentially what we want to do. And it's going to be beneficial to our patients. So I'm not going to argue that point. The second thing that this paper really discusses is the phenomenon of desaturation and ways that we can optimize this to where we're not having that desaturation. And one of the concepts that they discuss is using BiPAP, or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, during the procedure to provide good alveolar recruitment and optimizing that PO2 as high as possible. And I think that this is a great way. This is another thing that I was discussing with Alan, and you know, we were emailing back and forth and having this conversation, and he brought up a great point, and I fully agreed that that's not really applicable to our setting. We can't bring the ventilator to the bedside. We can't bring the ventilator to the bedside in the back of an ambulance prior to an RSI. So that really doesn't fit our setting or our situation. Another thing that we have to remember is what we're trying to provide. We're trying to provide nitrogen washout. We're trying to displace the nitrogen that's left in our alveoli during normal breathing. Remember, we have 78% nitrogen that makes up our atmospheric air. We have 21% oxygen. So it's the dominant gas. But nitrogen is also something that maintains our PEEP. That's what's left over after our oxygen is diffused through the alveolar capillary membrane. But in an RSI situation, we want to try to cause a high pressure of oxygen in that alveoli, which displaces that nitrogen. Remember, nitrogen is a very dense gas. It doesn't diffuse very, very readily. So we have to optimize that by improving the amount of oxygen, improving the FiO2 to 100%. And in the acute phase, in an RSI situation, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to optimize this. We want to cause nitrogen washout, which is going to increase our PO2. And a great rule of thumb is the FiO2 is always going to be 5 times what your desired PO2 is going to be. And so to explain that a little bit different, to understand what your desired or what you should see on your PO2 on a blood gas should be 5 times what your FiO2 is. So if you're delivering 100% FiO2 to your patient, multiply that by 5, and that should give you a PaO2 or PO2 of 500. Now, obviously, that's in a normal homeostasis, but that is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to drive up that PO2 as high as possible to give us that time during the RSI procedure. The other thing that I found very, very interesting in this study was the use of paralytics. And they looked at the use of paralytics and they identified, does one paralytic give a patient a better outcome? And what I mean by a better outcome is, does it provide any difference in the time the patient has to desaturation during this procedure? And they found a huge difference. So they compared succinylcholine and they compared rocuronium. And this was done in a separate study. But they cited this study, and what they found was a big difference. In patients that were given rocuronium, the patients desatted in 378 seconds, which is about 6.5 minutes. In patients that were given succinylcholine, those patients were desatted in 283 seconds, which is about 4 minutes. So there was about a 2.5 minute difference in desaturation based on just the paralytic that they were given. Now, we know that succinylcholine is a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent. It essentially binds with that neurosynaptic junction. That acetylcholine fills those neurosynaptic junctions and it causes massive muscle firing. So this is probably why this causes a quicker desaturation, because you have to understand, if it's firing all those muscles firing are utilizing and consuming oxygen. So that is reducing our O2 stores. With rocuronium is a competitive neuromuscular blocking agent. So essentially it blocks those neurosynaptic junctions from getting filled with acetylcholine. It doesn't allow for any muscle firing. Based on that, it's going to reduce O2 consumption, and it's going to limit that. And so your available stores of oxygen are going to remain higher. So to me, I found this very, very big as far as providing what we could utilize this for in our clinical practice. Now, if you know me and you've heard me lecture on this, I'm a big component on we shouldn't do anything different based on the paralytic we give. I fully feel comfortable giving rocuronium to a patient that I'm RSIing for initial paralyzation. Absolutely. We'll do this exact same things with that patient in comparison to a patient I'm giving succinylcholine with. I'm going to use the same equipment. I'm going to use the same techniques. If I miss the first attempt, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to change something on the second attempt. If for some reason I can't get the intubation, I'm going to use a backup airway just like I would with succinylcholine, just like I would with rocuronium, and you could argue the same thing with vecuronium. There's a lot less side effects with ROC than there is with succinylcholine. And so for me, I'm starting to lean towards rocuronium being the best paralytic to use in the pre-hospital environment based on all of the different things that it provides to our patients. So I will put this study in the show notes. Please read it. It's a really good read. Obviously, if you've listened to Scott Weingart's podcast, you know that he is the patriarch to critical care podcasting. Again, he is what inspired me to start the Fly Bridget podcast and bring that level of education to the pre-hospital environment. So I'm constantly learning from him and trying to apply the concepts that he brings to the table to our environment, to the HIMSS industry and pre-hospital environment. I think this is a great article, great things that we can apply to our practice. So that's all I have for this podcast. Again, thanks so much for the following, and I will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.